are going to continue our sermon series today. We're going to just continue moving on. We're going to be talking about one of my, a story. We almost named our son after this person we're going to be talking about today. And again, before we start, I just want to give a couple of disclaimers like I do when I preach this every time. The first one is I love that we teach kids Bible stories, right? I love that they can get in the Word and they can learn of the Word of God. It's such an important thing. And when we teach them as kids, right? Like they don't need every detail. They need to see the big picture of the story. They need to see some of those things. The trouble comes with a lot of us learn these Bible stories as kids and our understanding of the story has never grown as we grew. Right? Like, and that can be a problem. The other thing that happens sometimes is we get so caught up in who the story is about that we forget that every story in this book ultimately comes back to being a story about God and how he deals with people. Right? There is no, like we talk about it all the time, the heroes of the Bible and all those kind of things. And listen, many of these people did amazing things, but none of them were possible without God. Not a single one of them was possible without God. And so if you want to say they trusted in God and did this heroic thing, that's fine. But what happens is sometimes we think of the person in the story as the one that's accomplishing the work. And they were very aware that they weren't. Right? When you read these stories in the Bible and you see these things happen, they were very aware that the miracle was happening through God, not them. And it's such an important thing for us to keep those things in mind as we read through. I hope that you have a Bible. I hope that you are in that Bible all the time. I hope that you're growing and understanding who Jesus is. It's such a big thing as we go through these things. And help us, and God, help us remember those things. We're going to be in Judges chapter 6 today, all right? Judges is toward the beginning of the Bible. It's more toward the front than the back. You're going to be in there. And we're in a time in Israel's history where they have no king. Okay, it's before there's a king. You read that over and over again in scripture. This was a time in Israel when they had no king because God didn't set Israel up to be a political thing. Right? God didn't set Israel up to have a king or to have a president or any of those things. God's original intention for the nation of Israel was that God would be its king. Right? And so he used these judges, though, as temporary, like, focus points on deliverance and those things. And so what happened in this time frame in the book of Judges, and we've talked about this here before, but if you're a guest, I hope you hear this. What happens is, in the book of Judges, so much what happens in our lives to one degree or another, hopefully not as extreme as Judges. But what happens is, right, like, the nation of Israel is serving God, and things are going well. And eventually, the nation of Israel gets complacent in their relationship with God because things are going well. And so they stop serving God, right? They start chasing after Baal or Asherah, all of these different gods of the day. And God says, okay, if you want to do life without me, I'm going to remove my protective hand over you and you can see how it really goes, right? And bad things happen. The nation itself makes all kinds of compromises, and eventually another nation comes and conquers them, okay? At least parts of who they are at this time, because it's not a nation at this point in time. It's separate tribes all over their land up there. And so somebody will come, and they'll conquer part of it, and eventually those people will be like, oh, yeah, you know, my great-grandma used to talk about a god that she served that did some pretty cool things. Maybe we should turn back to that God. And so the nation of Israel would cry out to God. God would send a judge. That judge, through the power of God, would bring deliverance for the people. And then they'd all be serving God. And then things would be easy. And they'd get complacent. And they'd compromise. And then God would allow another nation. And Judges is just a giant cycle. And the problem is Judges starts up here like they're serving God. And then slowly the curves get lower and lower and lower and lower as they make further and further compromises. Fewer and fewer people actually come to God even when he brings deliverance. And the judges themselves even become people that I don't know if you would trust to watch your kids. You know, like they start to become pretty messed up people, you know, but God is still using them somehow and bringing deliverance. And ultimately then it kind of hits rock bottom and then you kind of see the kings come in. But that's where we're at. And there's this judge in Judges chapter 6. We almost named our son after this judge. Gideon, I think Gideon has my favorite God greeting in the Bible, right? And we're going to get there, but the angel of the Lord shows up and says, "Hail, mighty man of valor." I love that. What an amazing greeting. We almost named Titus that, but with a last name like Kirschman, and I know that doesn't sound much, but if you actually see it written down, you'll understand what I mean. We just decided not to make his first name Gideon because he didn't need that many syllables and that kind of thing in his life. So we went with Titus, but Judges chapter 6, verse 1, the Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight, so the Lord handed them over to the Midianites for 7 years. The Midianites were so cruel that the Israelites made hiding places for themselves in the mountains, caves, and strongholds. Verse 3, whenever the Israelites planted their crops, marauders from Midian, Amalek, and the people of the east would attack Israel, camping in the land and destroying the crops as far away as Gaza. They left the Israelites with nothing to eat, taking all the sheep, goats, cattle, and donkeys. I mean, you need to hear that, right? This is not a good time. This is not a pleasant time. This is a time of starvation, right? When you have to leave your homes and your cities to hide in caves, that's not a great starting place. And then when you can't produce food and no one will trade food with you, then things get real desperate. Things are bleak. Verse 5, these enemy hordes coming with their livestock in tents were as thick as locusts. They arrived in droves or on droves of camels, too numerous to count, and they stayed until the land was stripped bare. That's actually kind of a funny verse to me, not the stripped bare part, but too numerous to count, because later on we get a count of how many there were. But we didn't want to write it twice. So Israel was reduced to starvation by the Midianites. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord for help. I don't know about you, but I can relate to that. I like to blame it on being a German, but at 44, it's probably just my own dumb fault that I'm so stubborn. Why do we wait so long to cry out to God for help? Why do we wait until we're at the point of starvation and hiding to cry out to God for help instead of remembering him in the good? Maybe you do. Maybe you remember God all the time in the good and you cry out to him right away. But I'll tell you, and throughout my life so many times, it's like I don't want to admit I need help until things are so bad that there's literally nothing else I can do. And can I tell you, we could learn from Judges not to be that dumb. I'm sorry that I'm calling people in the Bible dumb, and you maybe sometimes too, but I'm really referring to myself. It's dumb. I've seen God work so many times. In so many ways, and yet so many times, he's my last look instead of my first look. Why? It's ridiculous. You wait till you're in the point of starvation, right? We wait till our marriage we've literally had people come into our office and say they've had a marriage or a divorce certificate in their hands and say, if you can't give us a reason to stay together, we're gonna go file this. Why do we wait so long to get help? Why do we wait until all of the joy is sucked out of our lives and we're so miserable that we're making the people around us miserable before we go to God and say, I need to find your joy again? Why do we wait? The Israelites did. It's not a great example. And so you see the Israelites, God sends a prophet to them. The Lord says he's going to bring out some things like that. But again, he tells them, you haven't listened to me. And we're going to drop to verse 11. Then the angel of the Lord came and sat beneath a great tree. I want to just pause for a second here, and I'm going to give you a little bit of conjecture. But when you see the angel of the Lord, right, in the Bible, that's almost always going to be Jesus. in the Old Testament, right? Like when you're reading through the Bible and you're reading the angel of the Lord, don't think, I've talked about this a lot, but please don't think like winged diaper baby holding a harp. Like that's not angels in the Bible, okay? Like, but the angel of the Lord, most scholars would agree that that's probably Jesus coming down, the sun coming down in the Old Testament. Whether or not you think that's true, that's okay. But I want you to know that this is not just the angel of the Lord comes. Right? Where am I at? Verse 11. Then the angel of the Lord came and sat beneath a great tree at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash of the clan of Abiezer. Gideon, son of Joash, was threshing wheat at the bottom of a wine press to hide the grain from the Midianites, right? So he was in a place not suited for the task, but he was hiding. So hopefully he could bring some grain home before the Midianites took it. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, "Mighty hero, the Lord is with you," or "Hail, mighty man of valor, the Lord is with you." Gideon's response is hilarious because it's like so many of ours. "Sir," verse 13, "Sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? And where are all the miracles our ancestors told us about? Didn't they say the Lord brought us up out of Egypt, but now the Lord has abandoned us and handed us over to the Midianites?" Then the Lord turned to him and said, "Go with strength you have and rescue Israel from the Midianites. I am sending you." Verse 15. "But Lord," Gideon replied, "how can I rescue Israel? My clan is the weakest of the whole tribe of Manasseh, and I am the least in my entire family." A couple of things happen here. The angel of the Lord appears to Gideon and addresses him about how God sees him, and Gideon doesn't get it, right? The angel of the Lord shows up and looks into who he is and says, "I know what you can be if you give me your heart. Hail, mighty man of valor." And isn't it one of those moments when you look like you see it on cartoons or TV shows, but can't you just see it, right? Like based on Gideon's response, the angel of the Lord greets him that way and he like looks over his shoulder. He doesn't get it. And he's like, "If God is so great, where is he? Bad things are happening all around me. I don't get it." We talked about this last week, and I want to reiterate it today. Our circumstances do not determine God's presence or his power. Sometimes things are hard because we live in a sinful, fallen world. Things just get hard. It doesn't mean God isn't with us. Sometimes we screw up over and over again and God gives us what we want, which is not good for us. But he says, "Where is God? Where is this great God that I've heard my ancestors talk about?" And the angel of the Lord really doesn't even respond to that other than to say, "Go do what I told you to do. Go with the strength you have and rescue the Israel from the Midianites. I'm sending you." I want you to hear that for a second, because God doesn't say in this point in time to him, "Go with the strength I have." Gideon's first response that he is told to do by God is to go in his own strength. Do you see it? Go in your own strength. And he makes an excuse that I think most of us would. But listen, I'm from the tribe that nobody remembers, right? Like if I asked you to name the 12 tribes of Israel, how many of you would have remembered Manasseh before we just read that, right? If you have them all memorized, you'd get there. But if you don't, you'd probably be like, "I know there's a Judah in there somewhere. And he just talked about Simeon last week. And now I'm struggling." You know, like Manasseh, it's a tough one. And so he's going through and he's like, "I'm from the smallest tribe and I'm the least in my entire family." Read that two ways, because this word has two meanings and I'm not sure which one exactly, right? When he says I'm the least in my entire family, he could have meant one or he could have meant both, but it can be translated either way. I'm the youngest in my family, okay, which is a sign that you're like the lowest on the inheritance rank in the way that they do things. So you would really kind of be overlooked in a lot of ways. Or he could literally be saying, "I am the smallest guy in my family. Like my brothers are all huge. I'm the little one." You could read it either way, okay? And either way, he's saying, I'm not good enough. And the Lord then says to him, finally, I will be with you, and you will destroy the Midianites as if you were fighting against one man. Remember, they just said, there's so many of them that you can't count them. And now the Lord looks at him and says, it's going to be like you're fighting one guy. Okay? And you go through and you see all this stuff. And there's actually this progress or this progression here where Gideon doesn't start fighting the Midianites. He starts by going into his own village and tearing down the Asherah pole. Okay? If you study history at all, we're not going to go into it all today. Terrible things happened around those poles. It was a pole to a goddess that was absent, and I say that with a small g, but a goddess that demanded terrible things from her followers, and she couldn't demand anything because she's not real, but her followers made up these things. I mean, you're talking child sacrifices. You're talking terrible things happened at those poles, and Gideon goes in there, and he tears down the pole. He tears down the altar to Baal, and the people get ticked. They cried out to the Lord for delivery, but they're still mad that he's messing with their false religions. And they say in verse 30, bring out your son, the men of the town demanded of Joash. He must die for destroying the altar of Baal and cutting down the Asherah pole. Do you realize how far Israel has fallen when they're not only tolerating these places for the other gods, they're now defending them with the lives of other, they're calling for the life of another Israelite to defend it. Do you realize how far they have drifted from what God told them to do in the book of Exodus? They have allowed drift to happen. But Joash, you can see it in the next verse, Joash is like, let these gods defend themselves if they're real. If they're real, they'll take care of themselves. They're supposed to be a god. Let them take care of themselves. Verse 32, from then on, Gideon was called Jerubbaal, which means let Baal defend himself. So they nicknamed him by it. And then you can see through here, Gideon does what so many of us have done, right? God says, I want you to do this big thing. And Gideon is like, all right, I'll do it. But first, I need a sign. Okay? Can I tell you that this is God answers Gideon's prayer right here, but there's lots of times in the Bible where people were asking for signs, and Jesus himself is like, you don't need another sign. You just need to believe what you've already seen. It's dangerous to start letting signs be how we determine what to do with our lives, right? We have the word of God. We should take time and we should pray. But sometimes God has answered these, but most of the times when you see people ask for a sign like that, it is not looked upon super well. I think God gave Gideon a little bit of a pass here. This is my own opinion. Please don't take this as gospel, because Gideon doesn't really know anybody who's really been serving God. You heard him talk about it. It was the faith of our ancestors, not his faith. It was the God of our ancestors. And so I think God is kind of demonstrating again who he is as he's asking him to do this big task. But I want you to hear. So Gideon asks that God would, he put this fleece, he put this thing of wool on the ground, and he asks that the fleece be wet and the ground be dry. And he wakes up in the morning and it is, right? And so as if that's not enough, then he's like, one more thing. This time I want the ground to be wet and the fleece to be dry. And it is. Can I just tell you, like, that happened in scripture, but how much more do you need than seeing the angel of the Lord show up? Right? Like, the angel of the Lord already appeared to him and said this. And I'm not trying to berate Gideon. I'm just trying to say God has demonstrated himself to you already so many ways. And yet we're always asking for signs. I've done that before. And like, I'm not asking for a small sign. I'm saying like, God, I need you to write it across the sky in fire. Because I don't want to do it. And I'm trying to use it as an excuse. Right? Maybe it's just me. Verse 7. So Gideon gets up. You can see at the beginning. He and his army got up early and went as far as the spring of Herod. The armies of Midian were camped north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, you have too many warriors with you. If I let you fight the Midianites and the Israelites, or if I let you fight the Midianites, the Israelites will boast to me that they saved themselves by their own strength. Therefore, tell the people, whoever is timid or afraid may leave this mountain and go home. God is not a human general. Because this is the worst battle plan of all time. If God required to do things the way that we do things, this is the worst plan ever, right? Like, send home 20. If you're scared or timid, like if you talk to most soldiers, you know, in the post time, and they talk about actually wading into a battle, even though they're these brave people, there's an element of fear there. Because we're humans and it's a scary thing, right? And so they go in and he's like, if anybody's afraid or feeling a little timid this morning, go home. 22,000 people leave. 22,000 go. But the Lord said to Gideon, there's still too many. Okay. So they have an army of 32,000, by the way, and 22,000 of them just left. Okay, over half. And God is like, nope, still too many. I know that they're too many to fight. You know, like you don't even want to count them all. But 10,000 of you, that's still too many. You could still claim it's you. So here's what I want you to do. Go to a stream and divide people into group, right? Anybody who cups water from the stream in their hands and drinks it, they're going home. Anybody who puts their face into the stream and drinks like a dog, they're the ones that are going to stay. And naturally, only 300 of the men drank like a dog, right? Because most of us would have scooped the water up instead of just burying our face in it. 10,000 more go home. Our army of 32,000 is now 300. God's like, okay, that's enough. That's good. Verse 7, the Lord told Gideon, with these 300 men, I will rescue you and give you victory over the Midianites. See, it's not about Gideon. It's not about the army. It's not about any of that. It's about the God they serve. Gideon was just an ordinary guy who served an extraordinary God. So Gideon collected all of the provisions and ram's horns of the other warriors and sent them home, but he kept the 300 men with him. I want you to hear, in verse 10 of chapter 8, we're given the total of the army they're going to face. It's 135,000 men. 135,000. You have to do a little bit of math, but there's 135,000 men. Think, you know, most of Duluth. Because I know those numbers get hard to understand. Most of Duluth is standing there armed and ready to fight, and they've got 32. So if you just do a little bit of math, we're not talking Rambo here, right? We're not talking like specialty guns. We're not talking about being able to drop a nuke on anybody. We're talking about hand-to-hand combat, maybe some arrows. Maybe at this point in time, they've got a few ranged weapons, but largely the battles were fought in the trenches, hand-to-hand. 135,000 versus 32,000, each warrior would have had to kill 4.21 men to win, to wipe out the army. 4.21. If you talk to people about hand-to-hand combat, that would be a pretty good day. To be able to wade into a group and take out 4.2 people all by yourself in that kind of a group, that's a good day. God said it's too many. So if they would have dropped down to 10,000, like after the first one, they each would have had to kill 13 and a half men. Can I tell you, that's probably the greatest army of all time. Hand-to-hand combat, greatest army of all time. When you drop down to 300, each one would be responsible for 450 people. One on 450. Your very best guy and your very worst fighter. You each need to take out 450. It's impossible. And that's exactly what God wanted. Because he doesn't want you to read this story and see how great Gideon is. He wants you to read this story and know how great God is. That's the point. That's the point. And so Gideon, you can keep reading. And as you keep reading, God sends Gideon down. And God actually gives Gideon another sign, even though Gideon doesn't necessarily need it. He hears a man dreaming about how, you know, about how these things are supposed to go, about how the Israelites were going to defeat them. And his companion even interprets the dream. In verse 14, your dream can only mean one thing, that God has given Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite, victory over us, right? And so then you can see there. Battle plan. Here's the battle plan, right? Verse 15, when Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he bowed in worship before the Lord. Then he returned to the Israelite camp and shouted, "Get up, for the Lord has given you victory over the Midianite hordes." He divided 300 men into three groups. So now we're gone from 300 in one circle to 100 each. Okay, they divide up, they kind of go around there. This is not much of, you know, like it's encircling them. But Gideon says, "Keep your eyes on me," verse 17. "When I come to the edge of the camp, do just as I do. As soon as I and those with me blow the ram's horns, you blow your ram's horns too, and the entire camp will shout for the Lord and Gideon." It was just after midnight. And they go up there, and here's the plan, right? You can see it in verse 19. Suddenly they blew the ram's horns and they broke their clay jars. That's God's battle plan. 32,000 is way too many. Let's cut you down to 300. Then we're going to send you into battle with a pot and a flashlight and a trumpet. I don't know if you can play or not, but you're going to have a trumpet and a flashlight. There's 300 of you. This is the best plan ever. I want you to hear the ridiculousness of it, because the only reason this story isn't laughed about is because God was involved. Nobody comes up with this plan. No general on the history of the earth has ever thought, you know what I really need less of in my infantry? I need less people in it. And instead of giving them swords and shields, I think what they really need is flashlights and horns. Now we're ready. It is ridiculous, because God needed them to know, this is not about you. This is about me. Now, I know some of you are listening to the VeggieTales thing, the Lord and the sword for Gideon, right? Like it's, for some of you, it's in your head right now. I know it. And if it's not, I just put it in there. But they go up and they do it. And you can see as they go, this is what happens. They do this. And as they go, they're told, you can read all the way down. Again, if you drop down to verse 10 of chapter 8, you can see by this time, Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with about 15,000 warriors, all that remained of the allied armies of the east. For 1,200 men, or 120,000 men, had already been killed. So there's 15,000 left. There's 120,000 that had already been killed. 300 people chase down an army of 135,000 people, and God allowed them to kill 120,000 of them. Again, lest you miss that number, that's basically, again, like Duluth and Hermantown and some of those towns all surrounding there. And again, why would God do this? You need to understand how cruel what was happening was. Again, right? God didn't say, just go attack these people. God said, they're attacking you, I'll defend you. Sometimes we feel bad for the wrong people in the story. I don't know. The point of the story of Gideon isn't how great Gideon it is. It is how much are you willing to listen to God when he tells you to do something, even if it doesn't make sense. I need you to hear, God has asked us to do something sometimes that don't make sense. Will you listen? I'll tell you the story again. I'll just tell the story real quick. I know some of you have only known me now. You started coming after I was a lead pastor here, but before I was a lead pastor, I was a youth pastor, and I loved it. I loved working with teenagers. When I got hired to come out to Grand Rapids from Montana, it wasn't to be the lead pastor. It was to be a youth pastor. I worked with the students. I loved working with students. Me and my wife, we felt like we were good at it. We did it. We loved it. And when Pastor Brian, who was the lead pastor here, died very unexpectedly, a little while later, the board came to us and said, we'd like you to at least pray about being the lead pastor here. And we just told them no. Like, I don't need to pray about it, because I already know I'm called to youth ministry. We know we're called to youth ministry. I think it was Dale Reed. I don't remember who I was that I talked to the first time, but he's like, I would like you to at least pray about it. I'm like, I'll pray about it, but this is a waste of both of our time. I'll be here to help you, you know, in the transition, but this is not my call. And I went home and told Mandy, I'm like, they asked us to pray about being the lead pastors. And Mandy is like, why? We don't need to do that. Because we weren't youth pastors who had dreams of becoming lead pastors someday. We, you know, like you go to some of these district things and they're teaching classes and some of the youth guys are always in the adult ones because they're youth pastors because that's their first step and then they want to be a lead pastor later. And that's fine if that's your call, but we weren't those people. The only thing we had studied about how to do well in that amount of time was youth ministry, right? It seemed ridiculous when we were approached by it. And even when we started to feel like God was changing our hearts, we were like, really, God? This is not going to go well. You know me, right? There was nothing natural about it that seemed right. Just didn't. Still today, I wonder what God was thinking. Some of you probably do too. It's not about it making a ton of sense. It's about following God into what he asks you to do. Sometimes God asks us to do things that make a lot of sense. We're prepared for them. You know, he's kind of put in that kind of personality and that skill set and those kind of things. And he's calling you to do something that you're going to be good at. And that's always a little bit more. We don't ask for, you know, signs of fire in those moments. It's when he asks us to do something that there's no way it can be accomplished except through him that we're like, I'm not sure if that's really God. You need to have people in your life that can pray with you in those things. Help you know whether or not it's God. People you trust that you can join with and pray with. You need to have a crew. The story of Gideon is not the story of Gideon's army. The story of Gideon is the story of how far someone was willing to go to do what God asked him to do. He stepped into the ridiculous. And because of that, God was able to do something miraculous. Israel didn't need another judge. They needed to have their faith restored in who God was. God knew what they really needed. They didn't just need deliverance from the Midianites. They needed to know who God was. And they couldn't do that if they could claim credit for it themselves. God's going to ask you to do something crazy sometimes. Are you willing to follow him into it? Are you willing to say yes when it doesn't make sense? It's important. It's important. I want to encourage you in this place. Trust in God. Because he's able. Trust in the God you've seen work. If this is your first time in church today and trusting in God is tough, start asking the people around you what God has done in their lives. And be encouraged by the stories. If you feel like God is calling you to do something today and you're not sure if it's God or if it's you, I want to encourage you to surround yourself with some people that you trust and talk to Jesus together. Trust in who he is. Let him work the miracle, all right?